I suppose.
Chapter 21. When I dragged myself downstairs in the morning, I found Alice and Hank in unusually good spirits, not in spite of being wrenched out of their beds in the middle of the night, but because of it. As they revisited the air raid over the breakfast table, the details matured. By the final retelling, Alice had made sure that everyone else was safely in the shelter before coming in himself. Hank had positioned himself on the bunk above Meg and me to shield us with his own body, and Mr. Ross was barely present. Anna's demeanor got stonier and stonier as she served and cleared breakfast. Hank decided he would write to Violet, musing that perhaps the idea of his being in mortal danger would loosen her draconian premarital rules.
"You and she are premarital now, are you?" said Alice. "Well, pre-premarital, at least," said Hank. "But still, I think I ought to be able to sample the goods. What if I wait until the wedding night and then find I'm stuck with something subpar until death do us part?"
"Hank," I said urgently.
"What?"
"In case you've forgotten," I continued in a lowered voice, "you're in mixed company."
"Darling girl, when did you become such a prude?"
"I don't mean me." I cut my eyes over to Anna.
"Oh,"
he said, furrowing his brow. He changed the topic to monster hunting, but not before giving me an odd look. It was perfectly obvious that he hadn't registered Anna's presence at all. The front door opened, and a handsome, ginger-haired man in shabby clothing came in. He nodded at Hank and Ellis, set the two baskets he was carrying on the floor, and turned his attention to the door, swinging it back and forth until he identified the point at which it squeaked most loudly. He was young enough to be fighting, and I wondered why he wasn't. Not that I would judge, but I was certainly sensitive to the issue.
"Well, what do you know?" Hank said to Alice. "It's George the Vanny. Maybe he'll give us a lift again."
"Aye, aye, George," said Anna, appearing behind the bar. "And how are you getting on?"
"You're seeing it, although it's right dank the day," he said,
closing the door and carrying his baskets to the bar. I couldn't help staring. He walked from side to side, almost like a penguin, swinging his right leg forward from the hip. The leg was false.
"And what have you got for me today?" asked Anna.
"Paraffin, naturally, plus a packet from the laundry and some things from the butcher."
"Well, let's see them."
"There's mutton shanks and some lovely sausages," said George,
hauling them out and setting them on the bar. The meat was unwrapped with a price drawn directly on it. Anna leaned over to sniff it. When she stood back up, she put her hands on her hips.
"And I suppose our sheets are also smelling like paraffin," she asked accusingly.
"Just pitching in to save petrol," said George. "They'll air out. Put them in the meat locker and they'll be right as rain."
"I am to put the sheets in the meat locker, am I?" Anna said with a long-suffering sigh.
It was apparently a rhetorical question, because she turned and took the meat through to the back.
"Shall I oil the door for you, then?" he called after her. "It screeches, like someone caught a cat by the tail."
He craned his neck, peering through the doorway and waiting in vain for an answer. Eventually he gave up.
"Well, I'm off then," he said to the three of us. "Tell her I'll be back to fix the door." "Say, I don't suppose you're going anywhere near the horseshoe, are you?" Hank asked. "I wasn't, but I suppose I could be. Same terms as before. Perhaps a little extra for your trouble." "I'd be a fool to say no," said George. "Are you ready now, or shall I come back when I've finished my rounds?"
Hank drained his tea and lifted his duffel bag.
"Ready when you are. Why don't you drop us off at the telephone and collect us when you're done? We have some calls to make."
Alice kissed my cheek before he left. Anna came back from the kitchen and cut the strings on the parcels of sheets. She flipped a few folds open and sniffed the creases.
"Oof," she said, waving a hand in front of her nose. "I'd hang these out back if it weren't for the snow. Maybe if I leave the quilts off and open the windows for a few hours. And I suppose it's paraffin pie I'll be making for dinner tonight."
She glanced sideways at me.
"I can't help but notice you've not gone with them for a week and a half."
"Can you blame me?"
"Not a bit," she replied. "They're that sleek at you might turn around and find they've left you at the side of the road."
After a few seconds, I said, "Anna, can you teach me to knit?" She had started refolding the sheets. She stopped.
Come again?
You once asked if I could knit. I can't, but I want to. I want to knit socks for the soldiers.
It's not as easy as that, she said, looking at me strangely. It's difficult to turn a good heel. There are competitions over it.
What about squares? Surely I could learn to knit squares. Are those also for the soldiers?
Mrs. Hyde, she said. Maddie, please call me Maddie. I'm very sorry, but I don't have time to teach you how to knit.
Then can I help you with the housework?
She shook her head vigorously. Oh, I don't think so. No, I don't think that would be wise at all.
But why, I pleaded. When we first got here, you accused me of lolling about by the fire, and it's true. It's what I do all day, every day, and it's driving me mad. But I'm stuck here until my husband either finds the monster or gives up on it. Please, your load would be lightened, and I'd be so happy to have something to do.
She frowned. Your husband would never approve, and I don't suppose Angus would either.
They'll never know. I won't say a word to anyone, and I'll turn back into my usual idle self the second anyone steps in the door.
Her hands went still, and I knew she was considering it. Have you ever made a bed? She finally asked.
Yes, I said. Well, once.
She did a double take, then returned to folding.
I suppose if I changed the sheets, you'd only have to put the quilts back on. And Maher did ask me to pick up a few things at the shops this afternoon.
I can do more than just put the quilts on. I can also put their things away.
She gave a sharp laugh.
Well, that would be an immense improvement. I've fairly given up hope in that regard.
So have they, I said solemnly. Her eyes widened.
I beg your pardon.
She stared at me, daring me to deny it. Instead, I nodded.
Oh, no, they never did think, she said indignantly. They could not have expected.
Yes, they most certainly did. I raised my eyebrows for effect. And still do. Her eyes blazed.
Well, in that case, I'll just get these on the beds and leave you to it. Because if you don't do it, I cannot see how it's ever going to happen. And if nobody ever does it, I'll never be able to sweep the carpets again.
She scooped the sheets off the bar and sailed away, her bosom hoisted like the prow of a Viking ship. I don't know if I was more astounded at having talked her into the idea, or at coming up with it in the first place. While Anna changed the sheets, I flipped through the newspaper to see if there were any details about the bombs we'd heard drop. There weren't, but of course the paper would have already gone to press by the time it happened. There was plenty of other news, though. And as I read it, my optimism about having found something to do with my days crashed into bleak depression. The juggernaut that was the Russian army was now only 165 miles from Berlin, and Marshal Stalin had announced that in one advance in Silesia alone, they'd left behind 60,000 dead Germans and taken another 21,000 prisoner. It was a victory for our side, but I could not feel anything but a grim acknowledgement of progress. So many dead. Only 2 weeks earlier, I'd found the idea of 3,000 men killed in a single afternoon nearly impossible to comprehend. The sheer vastness of 60,000 deaths was even more numbing. It made it almost possible to forget that each and every one of the dead had been an individual, with hopes and dreams and loves now snuffed. I did not see how this could go on. The world would run out of men. When Anna came back downstairs, I was sitting with the newspaper open in my lap, staring at the wall.
"You've not had a change of heart, have you?" she said.
"Not at all," I said, forcing a smile. I folded the newspaper and stood. "So, besides straightening everything and putting the quilts back on the beds, what else should I do? Fill the pitchers?" She frowned in temporary bafflement.
"Oh, you mean the jugs? Don't worry about that. I'll finish up after I've been to the shops."
"It's okay, Anna," I said. "Even I can't mess up filling pitchers, or rather jugs, and you can check my handiwork when you get back." She tissed.
"Oh, I'm not worried. Well, all right. Maybe I'll have a wee peek, but just for the first few days."
She dug a key out of her apron pocket and held it out to me.
"Here's the muster."
I took hold of it, but it was several seconds before she let go.
I started with Meg's room, which was easy because she was tidy, and worked my way down the hall. Hank's room was about as I expected. His clothes were mostly out of his luggage and scattered across the floor, and the rest looked like they were trying to make a slithering escape. I piled everything temporarily on the bed and began dragging his trunks and suitcases into the closet. One trunk appeared to be full of stockings and cigarettes, but when it refused to budge, I dug beneath the top layers and found dozens of bottles of liquor. They were buffered by straw and cardboard, but I was surprised they'd survived the trip. Hank's cache of international currency was so heavy I had to get down on my hands and knees and brace a foot against the bed to shift it, but eventually I forced it into the closet. I was out of breath. Although the window was wide open, my blouse was sticking to my back, and this was before I had even begun to address the remaining mess. It felt oddly intimate to be touching things like his socks and pajamas, never mind his underpants, but I soon got into a rhythm. At least he'd thrown his dirty clothes into one pile, so I didn't need to inspect anything too closely in that regard. Just when I thought I'd put everything away, I caught sight of something under the bed. It was a stack of postcards, and when I picked them up, was shocked to find I was looking at a naked woman. She was reclining on a chaise longue with her legs apart, wearing nothing but a long string of pearls and a tiara. I glanced through the rest of them, fascinated. I had never seen a fully naked body except my own. Ellis had always gotten straight to business, with as little displacement of clothes as possible, and always in the dark, and was surprised at how different they were. One lay on her back on a white horse, letting one leg dangle so the camera could focus on the dark area between her legs. Another was on all fours on a picnic blanket, smiling over her shoulder at the photographer. Her legs were parted, just enough that her dangling breasts were visible between them, so large they almost looked weighted. Mine were tiny by comparison. When I came to the final card and realized there was a naked man in it as well, pressed up behind the woman and cupping her breasts, I became suddenly self-conscious and eager to be rid of them. I pulled open the drawer of the bedside table, and as I did, saw a small package labeled Doughboy Prophylactic. I had always thought a prophylactic was a toothbrush, but when I saw the words, "For the prevention of venereal disease," I realized it was something quite other. I dropped the postcards inside and closed the drawer. I didn't want to learn anything else about Hank, and was glad that I'd finished his room. I braced myself for the next, afraid of what I might learn about Ellis. Although I thought I was prepared for anything, I was wrong. When I opened Ellis's door, I stopped in my tracks, utterly stupefied. It looked as though a bomb had gone off. Clothes of all kinds, including his underpants, were strewn everywhere, flung over the bedposts, the back of the chair, even over the fire irons. There were heaps in corners, under the bed and in the middle of the floor. His shoes, toiletries, and other sundries were scattered everywhere, and the only thing that had found its way onto the dresser was a slipper. I couldn't imagine how he'd managed to create such a mess. Then, with a wave of nausea, I realized he'd done it on purpose. I could see it clearly. Every time he discovered that his belongings still hadn't been put away, he'd upped the ante by reaching into the trunks and throwing armloads of anything that came to hand into the air, kicking it all as it fell. How else to explain the toothbrush sticking out of a shoe or the comb and hair pomade beneath the window? It was brutish, childish, and destructive, and it frightened me. I started in the far corner and worked my way out. I could think of no other way to approach the mess that wasn't overwhelming. When I opened his top dresser drawer, I found a photograph of Hank and him, standing on the beach at Bar Harbor, their arms slung casually over each other's shoulders and grinning into the sun. Beneath it was a photograph of Hank alone, standing shirtless on the deck of a sailboat, with his hands on his hips. His chest glistened, his arms and shoulders were muscled, and he smiled mischievously at whoever was behind the camera. There was no picture of me, although I must have been around. In the next drawer down, I found several monogrammed handkerchiefs folded into packets. I opened them and counted more than 100 of my pills. Then I folded them back up and left them where they were. I didn't want him to think that Anna or Meg had taken them. I had been locking my door only at night, but decided to start keeping it locked during the day as well. I wanted to see how long it took him to go through that many pills. I wondered if anyone other than Anna had seen the condition of Hank's and Ellis's rooms. I hoped not. I could only imagine what she thought of them and, by association, me. Both of them would come back and see that everything had been put away and think nothing of what the person who'd done it had seen or thought. Indeed, they wouldn't think of the person at all, except perhaps to feel victorious. Although I'd unpacked my own things after only a couple of days, I was ashamed of how much I'd always taken for granted. I wondered how Emily was faring, and wished I could let her know how grateful I was for everything she'd done for me over the years. I couldn't imagine it was easy being Edith Stonehide's maid at that particular moment in time. When the rooms were all finished and I'd replaced the quilts, closed the windows, and put up the blackout frames, I slipped a few pairs of silk stockings from my own supply into Meg's top drawer. Chapter 22. When I returned to the kitchen, Anna looked at me in surprise.
"Surely you're not finished," she said.
"I am."
"And you've put all their things away?"
"I have."
"Well, if that doesn't call for a cup of tea, I don't know what does. Get settled by the fire, and I'll be right out. I think we deserve a proper stroop hug, don't you?" "So, are the sheets still smelling of paraffin?" Anna asked, sipping daintily from a teacup decorated with primroses and edged with gold leaf.
She'd brought out oatcakes and jam along with the tea, which was the strongest I'd seen yet, all of it served on fine china. She'd even put a doily on the tray. "I didn't smell anything," I said.
"Good, because the wash is not a job I'm keen on doing myself. There are some that won't send it out because they're afraid it'll come back with lice."
She harrumphed.
"Personally, I'm more afraid of what George will put next to it in that van of his."
"Why on earth would it come back with lice?"
"Because the same laundry facility also does the wash for the men at the big house and forestry camps. It's mostly old folk and wee frees who worry about it, but I suspect the real problem is that sending your wash out smacks of being a luxury. I'm just grateful Maher isn't of that opinion. She's about as strict as they come, being old and a wee free."
The top log on the fire slid toward us, sending up a cascade of sparks. Anna rose and jammed it back into place with a poker.
"And stay there," she scolded,
watching it for a few seconds before sitting back down.
"That may explain the old woman doing her laundry in the river the other day," I said,
"although it seemed a very odd place to do it." Anna set her tea down.
"I beg your pardon?" "I got lost in the cover, chased in by a crow of all things. I thought it was following me."
I was suddenly aware that the atmosphere had changed. I looked up to find that Anna had gone pale. I ran through what I'd said, wondering which part could possibly have caused offense.
"I'm sorry," I said, panicked. "I don't really think that."
Anna continued to stare at me. I put my tea down, afraid I would spill it.
"Please forget I said anything. I have an overly active imagination." "Who was doing laundry where?" she asked sharply.
"An old woman was washing a shirt in the river. She didn't answer when I asked for help. Then, when I tried to get closer, I couldn't find her. It was like she'd never..."
"Anna? Whatever is the matter?"
She'd clapped a hand over her mouth.
"Anna? What's wrong? Please tell me what I've done."
"The König," she said hoarsely. "You've seen the König."
I shook my head.
"What's the König? I don't understand." "Someone's going to die," she said.
"No, surely not. It was just an old woman, wearing green." I hesitated. "Yes."
"Did she have a protruding tooth?"
I hesitated even longer.
"Yes." "Was she crying?"
This time I didn't answer, but apparently my eyes gave me away. Anna shrieked and bolted into the kitchen. I called after her and then ran after her, but she was gone, leaving the door flapping on its hinges. I ran back to the front door, but by the time I stepped into the road, she was receding into the distance on her bicycle.
"What's going on?" Mr. Ross said.
I whipped around. He and Connell had come up behind me in the street. She thinks I've seen the König, I said helplessly.
And what made her think that?
Because I saw an old woman washing a shirt in the river. He took a sharp breath that whistled through his teeth. But how can that mean someone's going to die? I said desperately. It was just an old woman. I don't understand.
Anna still has two brothers at the front, he said.
Still? I turned to look down the road where she'd disappeared. I went upstairs and hid in my room, but about an hour before Meg usually returned from the sawmill, I began to panic. Anna had not come back, and she always started the dinner, which Meg then finished and served to the customers. Eventually, I crept downstairs again, thinking I'd at least better warn Mr. Ross that there would be no food to serve, but there was no sign of him either. I didn't know what to do, but since I'd somehow managed to cause the problem, I ducked into the kitchen and scoured the pantry for the makings of a meal. I realized almost immediately that it was hopeless, not only because I couldn't find any of the meat I'd seen delivered that morning, but because even if I could, I wouldn't have had a clue what to do with it. I wasn't even sure how to starch potatoes, and in about an hour, upward of 20 men would start arriving, each of them expecting to be fed. When Meg came in the back door, she found me leaning over the butcher's block table, my head buried in my hands. She quickly assessed the situation, her eyes landing on the empty range. "Anna left early," I said. "What's happened?" "I said something to upset her."
"And what was that?"
"I'm not exactly sure," I said miserably. "But I can tell you I didn't mean to do it." I expected her to grill me, but instead she simply set her coat and gas mask on the chair and said,
"Right then, can you get the tatties going?"
I blinked a couple of times. "Yes, I think."
"You think or you can?"
"I think." The truth was, I didn't even know how to slice bread. During my ravenous adolescent raids of the kitchen, I'd torn the bread off in chunks, digging out the soft middle to eat first, and then gnawing at the crust over the sink so I could rinse away the evidence. Meg told me to fill the largest pot with water, add salt and 40 potatoes, and put it on to boil. She soaked the fire herself while instructing me to hurry up about it so my husband didn't come back and catch me where I didn't belong, because she had a feeling that wouldn't go very well. Then she went out back to retrieve something she called potted hock, for which she thanked the dear Lord, for she had some on hand, and it was served cold. The bar was abuzz that night with news of the bombing, which distracted somewhat from the mashed potatoes, which tasted as though I'd boiled them in seawater. I also hadn't realized I was supposed to remove the skin, or dig out the dark spots, or that the knife was supposed to glide smoothly through before I declared them done, all of which Meg explained to me later. I saw more than one man lift a full fork, examine it with disbelief, and then attempt to fling the potatoes back onto the plate to see how tenaciously they stuck. Poor Meg. Although there wasn't a man in the room brave enough to complain, she was assumed to be responsible. Connell, who joined me by the fire as soon as Hank and Ellis arrived, didn't seem to mind how gluey they were. I was convinced that he'd come because he knew I needed moral support, so to thank him, I began slipping him tiny bits of mashed potato on the end of my finger, which he gravely licked. At one point, I thought I saw Mr. Ross watching when I had a potato-dipped finger extended in offering. Apparently Connell thought so, too, for he stared straight ahead and ignored it until his master's attentions were elsewhere. Only then did he tip his head toward me and let his tongue sneak out the side of his mouth. Since the bombing hadn't made it into the paper, people were adding their own bits of knowledge to the general story. Hank and Ellis listened with great interest. Two bombers had flown down the Great Glen from Norway, targeting the British aluminium plant in Foyers, a village several miles down the other side of Loch Ness. One night guard had been killed when the blast threw him into the plant's turbine, and another died of a heart attack. When someone shared the news that one of the Heinkels had gone down in Loch Lochy almost immediately after, I gasped and looked at Mr. Ross. He finished pulling a pint and slid it across the bar to one of the locals, as though he hadn't heard.
"Well, what do you know?" said Hank,
his voice betraying a sliver of respect.
"He shot down a bomber with a fucking rifle. I wonder why he's not fighting." "That's a very good question," said Alice.
He twisted in his seat and said,
"Say, bartender, my friend here has a question for you."
"Don't," I whispered, utterly appalled.
"Why?" he asked.
"Because it's none of our business," I hissed. "And he's the landlord, for goodness sake, not the bartender. Can't you show a little respect?" But it was too late.
"And what would that be?" asked Mr. Ross.
"You're pretty good with a gun," said Hank. "Why aren't you at the front?"
The room went silent. Mr. Ross simply stared at Hank. It was Rory who finally spoke.
"That's funny," he said slowly. "We've been wondering the same about you." "Medically unfit," Hank said,
as though it were all a joke.
"You look healthy enough to me." "I have a condition called pes plenus," Hank said. "Do you now?" said Rory. "Is that Latin for yellow belly?"
Hank jumped to his feet. The lumberjack also rose, but slowly. He was clearly more than a match for Hank.
"Hank, sit down," I pleaded. "And let him get away with calling me a coward."
"If the shoe fits," said Rory.
"Alice, are you going to just sit there and let him call us cowards?" Hank said, outraged.
"He wasn't talking to me," Alice muttered.
"As a matter of fact, I was," said Rory.
"Have you got some fancy diagnosis for lily liver, too? Planus lilicus, perhaps?"
"I have protanopia," said Alice. "I can't see color. And for your information, I tried to enlist twice."
"The lot of you should mind your own business," said Meg, coming out from behind the bar.
"It is my business if he calls me a coward," said Hank.
She threw him an exasperated look, gave up, and turned to the lumberjack.
"You can't fight him, Rory. You heard what he said. He's got a medical condition. He can't go around beating up invalids."
Hank opened his mouth to protest, and Alice whacked him on the side of the leg.
"They don't look sick," said Rory.
"Well, you don't always, do you? George the Janny looked just fine until he dropped dead of a weak heart. You can't fight a man with pes plenus. You might kill him on the spot."
Rory stared at Hank for a long time. He finally returned to his seat.
"I suppose you're right," he said with a sigh. "It would be like kicking a puppy, wouldn't it?"
"Of course I'm right, you daft fool," said Meg, slapping him on the arm.
He responded by slapping her bottom. She whipped around and pointed a finger in his face, but he just laughed and blew her a kiss. She glared at him and sailed back behind the counter. As the rest of the men returned to their conversations, Hank and Alice sat in silence, both of them ashen. Chapter 23 Anna showed up the next morning and served breakfast as though nothing had happened. I wondered whether she'd decided that the deaths in foyers had satisfied the König's ghoulish requirement. I watched her surreptitiously, hoping that the fragile thing that had sprung up between us hadn't changed, and that she'd still let me help with the rooms, but I had to wait to find out, because Alice and Hank were still there. Neither of them said a word about their rooms having been put straight. Instead, they sputtered indignantly about why everyone thought it was all right to judge them, when clearly Blackbeard was as fit as anyone else, except for his missing digit, which just as clearly didn't prevent him from shooting a gun. They said all this right in front of Anna, as though she didn't exist, and I cringed with embarrassment. She was at the far end of the room, sweeping the hearth with a broom made of sticks. She acted impervious, but I knew she wasn't. I had almost given up hope of them ever leaving when George the Vanny showed up.
"I've oiled yon door for you," he said,
glancing bashfully at Anna and swinging it back and forth.
"Yesterday afternoon when I came back."
"That's very kind of you," she said, without looking at him. He stared openly for several seconds, and from his stricken expression, I could tell he was in love with her.
"Well, I'll be waiting outside then," he said to Alice and Hank. "We'll be right out. Oh, say, do you still have a compass?"
Alice asked, turning to me.
"We're missing one."
"It's in my right coat pocket," I said, "hanging by the door." He went over and rifled through it.
"When did you go into botany?"
he said, looking into his palm. He came back and dropped a handful of the red and fawn toadstools on the table.
"Throw these out. They look noxious."
There was a flurry of activity as they got on their coats and hats and gathered their equipment. When the door finally closed behind them, The only sound was the rhythmic swish of Anna's broom against the stone floor. I wanted to start a conversation and figure out where things stood, but even though Hank and Alice had left, their presence lingered like a cloud of soot. Anna finally glanced up and said, "Those are elf cups you've got there. They're not poisonous, but they're also not tasty. They dry well, if you want to keep a bowl in your room." "I'll do that. Thank you," I said. "So what is wrong with them?" she asked. I didn't have to ask what she meant. Hank is flat-footed, and Ellis is colorblind. She raised her eyebrows. "I see. It's true. He can't tell red from green. It's all just gray to him. He didn't even know before he tried to enlist. There's absolutely nothing he can do about it, but people don't believe it. They think he's making it up. That's why we're here. He thinks that finding the monster will force people to recognize he's not a coward." "Does he now?" she said, and went back to sweeping. For a moment, I could think of nothing to say. I realized I was finished making excuses for either of them. "I suppose you've heard what they said to Mr. Ross last night."
"To who?"
"Mr. Ross. Angus." She laughed.
"Angus is a Grant. What on earth gave you the idea he was a Ross?"
"The sign," I said. "It says A.W. Ross. And then, on our first day here, you told me that he ran the place."
"He does run the place, but the proprietor is Alistair. Angus is just holding down the fort until Alistair gets back from the front."
She leaned the broom against the wall and put her hands on her hips.
"Have you thought that all along?"
Someone knocked on the door, a solemn, slow rhythm. Anna frowned.
"Well, I don't like the sound of that. Not one bit."
She wiped her hands on her apron and answered the door. Willie the postie was on the doorstep, holding his hat in his hands. His face was gray.
"And for what reason are you knocking, Willie?"
Anna said, in an angry voice that did nothing to mask her fear.
"The door is not locked. Come in, then, if that's what you're wanting. I haven't got all day."
"I'm very sorry, Anna," he said, without moving. "But you need to go home."
"What are you on about? I see naught in your hands but your hat."
"You need to go home," he repeated quietly. "I've just delivered a telegram."
Anna's knees buckled. She reached for the doorframe. I shoved my chair back and rushed to her, grabbing her by the waist.
"Your parents need you," Willie said. "Go to them."
She caught his wrist, gripping it so tightly her knuckles turned white.
"Which one was it?" she said frantically. "Tell me that much."
"Oh, no."
"Was it Hugh, or was it Robbie?"
Willie's mouth opened, but it was a few seconds before he spoke.
"'Twas Hugh,"
he finally said, lowering his gaze. She dropped his wrist and twisted free of me. She took a step backward, shaking her head, her eyes wild.
"You're wrong. It's not true. It'll be like Angus. You'll see."
Willie shook his head helplessly.
"Oh, no."
She took flight, bursting past him and out the door. When I tried to follow, Willie caught my arm.
"Let her go," he said.
He was right. I had no business intruding. When he realized I wasn't struggling anymore, he loosened his grip. I craned my neck past the doorframe and saw Anna pedaling furiously away, her bicycle jerking from side to side with the effort, her hair flying in the wind. She'd left everything behind, coat, hat, scarf, and gas mask. If I'd known where the croft was, I would have taken them and left them on the doorstep, but all I knew was that it was somewhere between the inn and the castle. I searched for the master key, eventually finding it on a hook under the bar. Then I made up the rooms, moving through the tasks like a robot. When I was finished, I went back and did them again. I lined the toiletries up at exact intervals on the dressers. I wiped the mirrors clean. I picked the wax off the candle holders and smoothed the surfaces of the quilts. And when there was nothing left to straighten or polish or dust, I went to bed. I stayed in my room that evening, despite Ellis's insistence that I join him for dinner. I could tell from his tone that he was in a foul mood, and when I stopped responding, his entreaties turned into accusations of mental instability. He threatened to send for a doctor if I didn't come out. I did not, and a doctor never appeared. Hours after everyone else had gone to bed, I continued to thrash, twisting the quilts around my feet and punching my pillow, trying to find a position that would finally allow me to rest, but nothing helped, because it was not my body that refused to go still. My throat was so tight I could barely swallow, and my eyes welled with tears. I knew with absolute certainty that if I'd gone upstairs right away, my mother would still be alive. But if I hadn't gone into the cover and seen the König, would Hugh also still be alive? I crept downstairs and sat by the fire, which had been dampened with a layer of ash. When Mr. Grant found me, I was on the floor in front of the grate, hugging my knees to my chest. I didn't hear him coming, or even notice the light of the candle.
"Is everything all right?"
he asked. I jerked around, pulling my nightgown over my ankles in an attempt to hide my bare feet. My cheeks were slick with tears.
"What's wrong? What's happened?"
He held the candle closer and looked me over. The lump in my throat had grown even larger, and it was difficult for me to speak. When I did, my voice was strangled.
"I did it, didn't I?"
"Did what, lass?"
He set the candle on the low table and knelt beside me, searching my eyes with his.
"What have you done?"
"I've killed Anna's brother."
"And how do you figure that?"
"I saw the König. I didn't want to see her, but I did. And then when I told Anna, she knew right away what it meant. I thought she was just being superstitious, but it turns out she was right. If I'd just stayed out of the cover, if I hadn't let that stupid crow chase me in, her brother would still be alive."
"Oh,"
he said, letting the word slide out on a long exhale. His expression melted into one of pity and sadness.
"No, no, lass, he would not."
"But I saw the König."
"You didn't do anything. It was a godforsaken war."
"But Anna's already lost at least one of her brother. How much loss are people supposed to bear?"
He shook his head.
"I'm afraid I don't know. It seems there's nothing so good or pure. It can't be taken without a moment's notice. And then in the end, it all gets taken anyway."
I looked wildly into his face.
"If that's the case, what's the point of even living?"
"I wish I knew,"
he said with a wry half-smile.
"For some time now, that's been a source of great mystery to me."
I looked at him for a few seconds longer, and then burst into tears, colossal heaving sobs that racked my shoulders. Before I knew what was happening, he'd wrapped his arms around me and pulled me to him, breathing heavily into my hair. I scrabbled onto my knees and tossed my arms around his neck, pressing my open, sobbing mouth on the pulse that beat so strongly in his throat. Chapter 24. It was an innocent embrace, I told myself for the thousandth time, hoping that I would eventually believe it. For hours after I returned to my room the night before, I lay in the dark, wishing he was there with me. I wanted him to hold me. I wanted to fall asleep in his arms. I was aware of wanting more, too. Despite being up most of the night, I got up early and waited at my door until Hank and Ellis were in the hallway. Then I joined them so we could all go down together. I was incapable of facing Angus. I could no longer think of him in formal terms, on my own. Even the thought of seeing him in the company of other people left me lightheaded. When the three of us went downstairs, he was standing by the front door, talking with a very old woman in a language both guttural and burbling. When he glanced at me, I thought my knees might give out. I couldn't look at him for fear of giving myself away. The air was so electrically charged, I was sure Hank and Ellis would pick up on it, so I also couldn't look at them. That left no one but the crone, who stared at me as if she were plumbing the deepest recesses of my mind and unearthing all kinds of terrible things.
"This is Rona," said Angus. "She'll be here until Anna gets back. She doesn't speak English."
And with that, he laughed.
"And the stellar service continues," Ellis muttered,
leading the way to our usual table.
"What are we supposed to do? Learn Gaelic? Play charades?"
"Why not?" said Hank. "It's always porridge anyway, and I can mime that."
He put his hands to his throat and pretended to choke.
"Don't tell me you're getting used to this," said Ellis.
Hank shrugged.
"At least they've started putting my things away."
Ellis harrumphed.
Talk to me when they start ironing the newspaper.
Rona served our breakfast in dour silence and otherwise ignored us completely. I wondered if she was the wife of the old man who'd blown our cover the first day. Even if she wasn't, it was clear she disapproved of us as much as he did. She was ancient, with a dowager's hump and bowed legs. Her hair was white, her clothes black, her complexion gray. She smelled like wet wool and vinegar, and as far as I could tell, wore a perpetually sour expression. Her upper lip and chin were lightly whiskered, her face so weathered that her eyes appeared as mere slits under the weight of her lids. Even so, I caught an occasional flash of piercing blue, usually as I was fighting off the memory of being held by Angus, or despairing of Anna's brothers, and wondering how two such disparate thoughts could coexist in my brain.
Maddie?
Alice was looking at me. His forehead was crinkled, and I realized he'd said my name at least twice, but I'd heard it from a distance, as though through a tunnel.
Darling, are you all right? You seem, I don't know, shaken or distracted or something. Are you having an episode?
No, nothing like that. I just didn't sleep well.
Why not?
I was thinking about Anna's family. I was here when she got the news about her brother.
What about her brother?
He was killed in action, I said. He's at least the second brother she's lost.
Ah, he said, smiling sadly. I suppose that explains why you wouldn't come down last night. But I'm afraid these things happen, my darling. C'est la guerre. How are you now? Should I have sent for a doctor after all?
I could only shake my head. He patted my hand and turned his attention back to Hank. I stared at him for a long time. If he wanted to end his search for the beast, he need look no further than a mirror. I collected my things and escaped as soon as Hank and Alice left with George, whom they'd apparently hired full-time, petrol restrictions notwithstanding. I wondered how fast Ellis was going through his remaining money. Perhaps Hank was already supporting us. After I got outside, I was free of Rona's penetrating glare, but found myself yet again with no destination, no goal, and no purpose on a day I desperately needed to be occupied. However, even if we'd shared a language, I wouldn't have had the nerve to ask Rona about doing the rooms. She clearly despised me. Once again, I'd been lumped in with Hank and Alice. My brain was fevered, my system overwhelmed. My glass had been filled too full, too fast. The König, the death of Anna's brother, my embrace with Angus, never mind finally recognizing the sheer callousness of my husband. Even after he'd shanghaied me into a war, even after I'd realized our entire marriage was a sham, even after I'd watched him go below deck to avoid seeing the wounded on the SS Mallory, I had never believed him to be as cold-blooded as he just revealed himself to be. I'd always assumed his avoidance of all things war-related was guilt, or for not being able to serve, but now I realized that he just didn't care. Even if he didn't think of Anna as quite human, had he never considered the fate of George's leg? Apparently not, since he'd interpreted my distress as a symptom of fragility. I thought of the moment Angus pulled me to him, gripping me tightly, not at all as though I might break, even as I was sobbing into his neck. We clung to each other, as though life itself depended on it, and maybe it did. I looked up with a gasp.
"It'll be like Angus," Anna had said, her face twisted in grief, less than a minute after laughing at me for getting his name wrong.
Was it possible? I marched down the street, keeping my head down, especially when the lace curtain in a front window shifted by the width of a finger, as nearly all of them did. If red was the new badge of courage, I was certainly a shining beacon of bravery, with my stupid red gloves and my stupid red gas mask case. I shoved my hands in my pockets and encountered the last of the elves' cups, which I flung to the side of the road for the crime of being red. Red, red everywhere. I wanted to be gray. I found myself back at the headstone, staring at its etched granite, as though I could force it to reveal its secrets. Agnes Marie Grant, infant daughter of Angus and Marie Grant, January 14th, 1942. Captain Angus Duncan Grant, beloved husband of Marie, April 2nd, 1909 to January 1942. Mari Joan Grant, beloved wife of Angus, July 26, 1919 to February 28, 1942. I knew how many men in the village had the same names. I'd seen it myself on the other gravestones, and I knew that Willie the Postie was called that to distinguish him from Willie the Joiner and Willie the Box, because every one of them was a Willie MacDonald. But I couldn't shake the image of Angus putting snowdrops on the grave.
It seems there's nothing so good or pure. It can't be taken without a moment's notice, he'd said,
and there was nothing so pure as an infant. Was it possible he'd returned from the war, only to find that everything he loved had been snatched by cruel fate? I thought back to the night we'd arrived in Scotland. When I realized it was the third anniversary of the child's death, I was afraid I might break into pieces after all. I was afraid that if I went back to the inn, I might take a pill, so I headed down the A82, knowing that somewhere between the village and the castle was the Mackenzies' croft. Small houses dotted the hillside, and I stopped briefly in front of each, wondering if Anna and her parents were inside. Eventually, I reached the castle and knew I had passed them. The ruined battlements looked very different than they had when we'd approached them by water. There was a large, dry moat around the castle, full of high grasses and scrubby weeds, and I lifted my coat and tromped down, across, and up the other side, ignoring the thorns that snagged my hams. Directly beside the entrance was a massive chunk of stone, or stones, really, because they were still stuck together with mortar, still rigidly holding right angles. It looked like someone had torn a large corner piece from a very stale gingerbread house and flung it to the floor. I paused beneath the arched entrance, where the drawbridge had once been, imagining all the people who had passed in and out over the centuries, every one of them carrying a combination of desire, hope, jealousy, despair, grief, love, and every other human emotion, a combination that made each one as unique as a snowflake, yet linked all of them inextricably to every other human being from the dawn of time to the end of it. I walked through it myself and went straight to the tower. Within its gloomy interior, I found a winding staircase and climbed the worn steps carefully. They were so narrow, I had to brace my hands on either side. I stopped on the second floor to look out, but pulled back immediately. Angus was standing at an arched gate that led down to the water. He stayed for a long time, staring at the lock, which was as flat as if it had been ironed. Then he leaned over, picked up his gun and a brace of rabbits, and turned around. I ducked further into the shadows, although there was no reason. He plodded straight to and through the main gate, without ever looking up. The light snowfall turned into a flurry, and before I knew it, turned into a blizzard. I had no choice but to return to the inn. To stay in the tower would mean freezing to death. Rona was neither upstairs nor in the front room, and although I had been desperate to get away from her just a few hours earlier, my need for a cup of something hot now made me just as desperate to find her. I hoped I would be able to pantomime what I needed, and that she'd be receptive to interpreting. I took a deep breath and entered the kitchen. When my eyes landed on the big wooden table and the freshly skinned rabbits upon it, I stopped. Angus was standing shirtless at the sink with his back to me, washing his arms. I knew I should leave, but I couldn't. I was rooted to the spot, watching the rhythmic, alternating movements of his shoulder blades as he cupped water first in one hand and then the other, sloshing it up past his elbows to rinse off the soap. I don't know what gave me away, but he whipped his head around and caught me watching. Despite my heart being lodged in my throat, I couldn't look away. After several seconds, he straightened up and, without breaking eye contact, turned slowly, deliberately, until he was facing me. His chest and abdomen were a network of thick, raised scars, red, pink, purple, even white. They were not puncture wounds. Someone had jammed a serrated blade into him and ripped through his flesh over and over and over. I stared, trying to comprehend. "Oh, Angus," I said, covering my mouth. I rushed a few steps toward him before coming to a halt. He smiled sadly and raised his palms. After a few seconds, he turned back to the sink. I reached a hand out as though to touch him, although a good 14 feet still separated us. The illusion was there, though, and I let my quivering, outstretched fingers graze his shoulder. When I realized what I was doing, I bolted to my room. I took my pills out and put them back no fewer than 3 times. I did not know what to do with myself, and ended up pacing between the bed and the window, turning on my heel as precisely as a soldier. Had he answered my suspicion about the gravestone? Had he been assumed dead and somehow survived? And what in God's name had happened to him? I couldn't imagine, and yet I couldn't stop imagining. Chapter 25. Ellis thumped on my door as soon as he and Hank returned, demanding I join them for a drink. I tried to plead an upset stomach, but once again he threatened me with a doctor, saying that this time he really meant it. As we walked toward the staircase, Ellis bounced off a wall. He was utterly soused. We took our usual spot by the fire. His and Hank's initial excitement at interviewing eyewitnesses had gone sour after only 3 days, and was compounded by Ellis's anger at not being able to view the site of the bombing, despite having traveled all the way around the lock to get there. He relived their outing from the comfort of the couch, sputtering about pulling rank and having someone's head, and other such nonsense. Eventually, his rant segued into the interviews themselves. He held his notebook open, stabbing it with a finger.
2 humps, 3 humps, 4 humps, no humps. Horse head, serpent's head, whale-shaped, coils. Goddamned white mane, for Christ's sake.
He threw his arms up in frustration.
Scales on another. Eyes of a snake, eyes at the ends of antennae, no eyes at all. Crossing the road while chewing on a goddamned sheep. Gray, green, black, silver, dorsal fin, flippers, all arms, no limbs, tusks. Tusks, for the love of God!
He glared at me as if I'd made the offending observation. When I didn't respond, he turned back to Hank.
Vertical undulation, flaring nostrils, otters, deer, lovelorn sturgeon, giant squid, rotten logs exploding from the bottom. The only thing we haven't heard is fire breathing with wings.
I'm sure we will, said Hank.
He was leaning back with his legs crossed, blowing rings of smoke.
How can you be so calm about this? How the hell are we supposed to figure out what's true when so many of them are obviously lying to us?
We should stop paying them, that's how, said Hank.
He successfully blew a smaller smoke ring through a larger one. He leaned forward and poked me on the knee.
Maddie, did you see that?
I did, I said. So did Angus, who was watching from behind the bar.
If you'd learned to smoke, I could teach you all kinds of tricks, Hank continued.
Watch this.
He exhaled a vertical loop before sucking it back into his mouth.
Hank, for God's sake, said Alice. Get back on topic. If we don't pay them, they won't meet us.
And if we do pay them, they'll lie. If people are willing to meet with us just to tell their story, they're more likely to tell the truth.
Hank turned to me.
What do you think, darling girl?
I really don't know, I said. I can see both sides, I suppose.
What was that?
Ellis said, swiveling toward me.
Would you please repeat that?
I said I really don't know.
No, you don't, he said. And yet you're always offering opinions.
I decided to ignore the insult and poked through the remainder of the pie. I was looking for pieces of rabbit because I didn't care for the mushrooms. Unfortunately, they were the same shade of brown. A fully formed thought crashed into my head, a coup de foudre. I put my fork down and looked at Alice, feeling my eyes grow wide. He had decided upon sight that the elves' cups were noxious, but there was absolutely nothing noxious-looking about them other than their red interiors.
"Stop gaping," Alice said. "You'll catch flies."
"Alice," Hank snapped. "What the hell is wrong with you? That's Maddie you're talking to."
"If you'll excuse me," I said, setting my napkin by my plate and rising. Ellis scowled and shook his head.
"Shall I walk you up?" said Hank, rising quickly.
"No, thank you. I'll be fine on my own."
"Yes, of course," he said,
although he came around the table and touched my elbow.
Maddie, he doesn't mean it. He's just being a knucklehead. He's under a lot of stress.
Stress, I said. Yes, of course. I tried to wrap my head around the enormity of what I suspected. If I was right, not only would it prove Ellis immoral on a completely different scale, it would also negate the entire purpose of this foolish, arrogant venture. Finding the monster wouldn't restore his honor, because he had no honor to restore. Over the course of the night, I became convinced. He hadn't crashed cars because he couldn't tell if the light was red or green. He'd crashed cars because he was drunk. Likewise, it was no coincidence that the dresses and jewelry he bought me were almost exclusively red. He knew it set off my green eyes, and the only reason I could think of for him buying me a bright red gas mask case was that it matched my gloves. The thing I found most abhorrent was that he'd made such a show about trying to enlist a second time, then acted so devastated when they turned him down again. The entire spectacle was designed to garner sympathy, which, incredibly, he seemed to think he deserved. It was a production worthy of my mother. I made sure I was the first one down the next morning, bringing my coat, gas mask, and gloves with me. I set the gloves on the table and waited. I was usually the last one down, so I didn't know who would arrive first. To my relief, it was Ellis.
"Good morning, darling," he said, kissing me on the cheek. "You're up early. Big plans."
I was momentarily shocked by his cheer. I wondered if he even remembered the previous night.
"Just tromping around the countryside," I said, trying to match his tone. "I wish I had my watercolors."
"Your paintings would be entirely washed away by the rain."
He pulled a logbook out of his duffel bag and opened it. I fingered my scarlet gloves, flattening the thumbs carefully against the palms.
"Yes, I suppose you're right," I said. "Which reminds me, I'm so glad you got a weather-resistant case for my gas mask. I'm sure a cardboard box would have dissolved by now."
"Nothing but the best for my girl," he answered.
"But I am curious why you got this color."
"To match your gloves, of course. Say, what do you suppose a fellow has to do to get some breakfast around here?"
He craned his neck, searching for Rona. "But my gloves are green," I said.
"No, they're not. They're red."
"No," I said slowly. "They're green." He looked down at the gloves and then lifted his gaze until it was locked on mine.
"Well," he said, just as slowly, "you told me they were red."
"Did I?" I said, still playing with the gloves. "That must have been another pair. These are green, and it's a rather odd color combination. I feel a bit like a Christmas wreath." I looked up. He was unblinking, his expression cold as granite. "Anyway," I continued, "if you find yourself back in Inverness, I could use a new pair. These ones have water stains all over them. And this time I would like red. Did you know there's a saying that red is the new badge of courage?" Hank appeared beside me.
"What's up, kids?" "What color are these gloves?" Alice demanded.
"What?" said Hank.
"Maddie's gloves. What color are they?"
"They are red," said Hank.
Ellis stood so suddenly, his chair legs belched against the stone floor. He tossed his logbook into the duffel bag, pulled the bag onto the chair, then yanked the coarse-toothed zipper so hard it took him 3 tries to get it closed. He threw me a final, searing glare and stormed outside. After a couple of seconds, Hank said,
"Christ, you two aren't falling apart on me, are you?"
Instead of answering, I stared into my lap. He pulled out a chair and sat.
"Is this about last night? He was just being stupid. He's under boatloads of stress. If the Colonel doesn't forgive him, he's seen the last send he's going to until we find the monster. And even then, the Colonel still has to forgive him."
"You underestimate the powers of Edith Stonehide."
"I hope so, because he sent her a letter yesterday morning. That's why he got so snockered last night."
I was shocked. "He wrote to her? What did he say?"
"Well, he didn't show it to me, but I assume he threw himself on her mercy and begged for divine intervention with the Colonel."
I had no idea he was going to write to her.
"He didn't want you to worry."
"Because I'm so delicate?"
"Because he wanted to protect you."
"Well, he has a funny way of showing it." Hank sighed.
If you're talking about last night, they're just words, Maddie. You know he didn't mean any of it.
I don't know anything anymore. I don't think he even remembers.